27th. We've got four bills set for initial public hearing and possible work session, and we're going to take them roughly in the order in which they appear on the agenda, and begin with House Bills 2017 and 2014. We have Representative Barnhart, the chief sponsor of those bills, to appear, so I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2017. Representative Barnhart.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2017 comes to you from Representative Barnhart. Allows the court in determining custody of minor child in a custody matter to consider a parent's ability to maintain a smoke-free environment for the child.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Phil Barnhart. I'm the state representative from House District 11. This bill is to amend ORS 107.137, which describes the considerations that a court should make in the determination of custody of a minor child under the statutes that relate to dissolution of marriage or annulment. 105 is the dissolution, and 135 is the section that refers to modifications of the court's order in those cases. And you'll note that Section 1 describes what the court shall consider, and there's a list of things on lines 8 through 18 that talk about that. And then I've added a new section, subsection 2 of that statute, which says the court may consider, to make it the line about the parent's ability to maintain a tobacco smoke-free environment for a minor child is a factor in determining custody, and then it repeats the statutory reference that's in Section 1. The purpose of this bringing this bill is to acknowledge a couple of things that I think we've learned in the last couple of years. First is the extreme danger to long-term health of secondhand smoke. We used to believe, of course, before the most recent Surgeon General's opinion, that the exposure to secondhand smoke was a relatively minor health problem. With the new statistical information that's available, the epidemiologists now believe that it's very dangerous, and of course we also know that children, because their organs are in a state of rapid flux as they grow, are more likely to be affected by toxins than adults who are mature. But this bill is also cautious because the purpose of it also is to recognize that there are many other factors in the determination of custody, as between parents who are dissolving or annulling their marriage, other than this issue, and that others are maybe considerably more important, and hence the different standard for the court's consideration. I would consider this to be a tiebreaker rather than an issue that a judge would use as a primary factor in determining custody.
Okay. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Barnhart, for bringing this bill to us. I have a question about former paragraph 3 that would now become paragraph 4, starting on line 28. It looks like right now the court can consider, it says conduct, I would say the ability to maintain a tobacco-free environment might be either conduct or lifestyle, if it's shown that that it may cause physical damage to the child. So is there any indication that that paragraph is not being interpreted to allow the consideration of the ability to maintain a smoke-free environment?
I'm reading the wrong paragraph. Let me start over.
It's the last paragraph
on
the page.
Yes, I see that now.
Lines 28 through 31.
Yeah, I was reading the paragraph above that, so I didn't understand the question. Let me read that again, and then I'll see if I can answer it. Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, I believe that the paragraph that I'm talking about adding to that statute is subsumed in subparagraph 4. I think that adding this paragraph, however, as a matter of emphasis on this point, is a useful tool in the process of encouraging the maintenance of a tobacco-free environment. mean, I certainly understand and believe that a court could consider the parent's ability to maintain a smoke-free environment as a factor that may cause physical damage to a child under current subparagraph 3 in the statute.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Okay. Thank you, then. You just remain there, Representative Barnhart. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2017 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2014. Council Plummer will get situated. Council, give us a little intro for this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2014 authorizes legislative assembly members to solemnize marriages. It also restricts legislative assembly members from charging or accepting payment for the solemnization of a marriage.
Okay, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, my name is Phil Barnhart. I'm state representative from House District 11. This matter came to my attention a few months ago when a former legislative assistant, actually two former legislative assistants of mine, approached me and asked me to officiate at their wedding. When I looked at the statute, I realized that legislators are not now in among the people who are authorized to, as it says in the statute, solemnize marriage. Those who are authorized to do it are judges, either state judges or federal judges. That's the Ann Aiken Amendment to the statute that was done a few years ago, allowing active federal judges to do it, or magistrates of the federal court. Also, the county clerks. And then it says religious congregations or organizations, or clergy persons of a religious or congregation or organization. Now, I think it's a well-understood a fiction that a number of people have become matchbox ministers as a result of this particular provision of our statute, which basically, because of the freedom of religion clause of our Constitution, doesn't allow the state to go behind a claim by a person to be a clergy person for the purpose of this statute. And so we have, charitably put, not clearly defined congregations that appoint clergy persons for this role. Other than that provision, the people who are authorized under this statute to solemnize marriages are clearly defined people who hold either elected or appointed positions in government. It seemed to me that it was no great stretch at that point to add an additional group of people to that list who are readily identifiable, elected to their positions, and certainly able to carry out this simple role in addition to the role that they carry as in their legislative positions. Judicial officers, of course, for the most part, are appointed or elected to do things other than solemnize marriage, and it's more a matter of tradition that they do so. Now, the other piece of the amendment, subsection 10 on the second page, is to deal with the potential concern of separation of powers, which allows legislators to do things that might be considered executive functions, although I'm not certain that this is an executive function, without dealing with because it doesn't allow for a fee to reduce that risk. But because the statute defines the those who can solemnize marriages now as judicial officers, officers of the county, or religious people with religious affiliations of a certain kind, already, it is unlikely that this would run into a challenge based on separation of powers, since if that issue exists, it's already thoroughly muddied by the existing statute. I have proposed a dash two amendment, which I hope you have in front of you. It was supposed to have been distributed to you, which allows the addition of the member of the governing body of a county and a mayor of a city to the list of those who can solemnize marriages. Again, the basis for doing that is we're talking about readily identifiable individuals who can easily who are already people of responsibility in our governing system.
Representative Barnhart, it looks like we don't have
the amendment. I'll see that that's distributed to you. The additional subsection of that is to add an emergency clause that would allow the bill to become effective immediately. And with that, I'll stop and answer any questions the committee may have.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you again, Representative Barnhart. I have a two-part question. First, do other states permit legislators to solemnize marriages? And are we free to decline if we don't want to marry somebody?
The answer to the first question is I don't know. And the answer to the second question is absolutely. Judges routinely decline from solemnizing marriages when they don't know the couple or they don't want to do it. My personal view is that you shouldn't be willing to do that for people that you're not acquainted with. There are other judges who, in my acquaintance, who routinely will marry people who have requested it in their offices or in the courtrooms that they regularly occupy. And, of course, the rest of this statute talks about fees that can be charged in that circumstance.
Mr. Chair, counsel, have you run across any states where legislators
As far as I've seen, it's often mayors and county. I did not see anything about other legislative members, but it's pretty scattered, actually.
Thank you.
Any further? Representative Krieger.
Representative Barnhart, you need one more amendment.
Yes, sir.
It's traditional that they have receptions and dinners. With House rules, you could not eat more than $9.99. I know you eat more than that.
Thank you for pointing that out, Representative Krieger. As a member of the Guidance Committee, that's something I should have thought of.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Barnhart, if a ordained licensed pastor became a legislator, would subsection 2, in other words, that person was able to charge a fee as a result of being an ordained licensed pastor, would subsection 10 now enable that person to, or not allow that person because they become a member of the legislature to collect a fee what they do in their professional life?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, the clear language of the subsection would not allow that, I think. That's a legal interpretation. I'll leave that to the bright lawyers to determine whether that's really true. It might suggest an additional amendment that would clarify that people who fall under different categories will be treated differently.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that would be like saying an attorney could no longer charge for his or her fees for now that they became a legislature for doing their business, so there would be a concern there.
Right, I agree.
Okay, I guess that sounds like there are several items that need to be covered here by amendment, and maybe we'd just kind of review what those are. Well, you indicated there was an amendment that has been requested, Representative Barnhart, that would expand the authority to include county executive officers, yeah.
Elected county
commissioners.
Right.
Yeah, or county judges, I think they're still called in some counties.
The way it says in the amendment is a member of the governing body of a county, which would be the county judge and the commissioners, or in the case of a home rule county, simply the county commissioners.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then to clarify the prohibition on receiving compensation so that it would a legislator who had served in another capacity for which compensation is allowed would still be able to receive that compensation.
Right.
And then an emergency clause which would allow this coming summer wedding season to be handled by by legislators. Have I reviewed all the items?
I believe you have, Mr. Chair.
$10 limit, too. At the reception.
I think that I'm venturing on ground I don't know that much about here because I haven't followed the ethics rulings that closely, but since these are people who would not have a legislative interest, I think we'd be all right.
I thank you, Mr. Chair, and I agree with that. I believe the first part of the requirement for compliance with our ethics rules is that the people involved have to have business before the legislature, and I would doubt that that would apply in this sort of a situation. It's possible it might for some other reason, but not because of getting married.
Right. Representative Cameron, did you have a
question? Just one other clarification. So, Representative Barnhart, you'd be able to do this as long as you were elected, but once you either resigned or lost an election, you would be ineligible to marry people in the future, but it's only through the time we have this blessing of being here that we'd be allowed to marry people, but once we're out of here, we couldn't.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, I believe that to be what this bill would do.
Thank you.
Okay, if there are no further questions, then I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2014. Thank you, Representative Barnhart, for presenting on these two bills. I think we will. We're going to take them in the order presented here because we have the requester here has been waiting. So, Councilor Kalmanson, if you could come forward.
I think it'd be easier to have him go be a box faster.
Is this from the first one? From the wedding, 14.
I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2959.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2959 prohibits county clerks from refusing to record an instrument because the instrument contains extraneous information. The bill requires county clerks to record instruments that are designed to correct errors in recorded trust deeds. It establishes that a person may record an instrument designed to correct an error in a recorded trust deed so long as the instrument, quote, otherwise meets the requirements for an instrument to be recorded under ORS Chapter 205. The bill creates a statutory form for creating errors in a recorded trust deed, which allows the beneficiary of the trust deed to correct a, quote, erroneous reconveyance or a, quote, erroneous recording of a trust deed and either reinstate or invalidate the trust deed. It establishes that reinstatement of a trust deed based on the correction of an error does not affect the rights of a bona fide purchaser or a security interest holder, so long as the interest in question was acquired after the erroneous trust deed was recorded.
Mr. Brickley, and Representative Esquivel is here to introduce this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sal Esquivel, Representative District 6. This bill today, I'm going to give you a little background where this bill actually started. It started last session. In my opinion, we had a situation last session where we were meeting with the county clerks, and one of the county clerks brought in a document saying that you can't record that document. Upon further investigation and looking at the document, there was nothing wrong with that document. It should have been recorded. So this passed here recently. We had another document that was refused by the same county clerk to be recorded. I took it to Jackson County and asked my county clerk, what do you feel about this document? No problem. Record it in a heartbeat. So obviously we have some discrepancies out there with some of the clerks. So we're trying to tidy this up a little bit, try to get some language in here to make it a little more uniform on what the criteria is. I believe we've been contacted by the County Clerks Association. I think Ms. Morales will testify here shortly. I believe he and myself and maybe Mr. Brickley will hopefully get together and make some small amendments to this particular bill, but that kind of gives you the picture of how we got here. So I'm going to turn this over to Alan Brickley, whom is the legal counsel for First American Title in Portland.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Alan Brickley. My office address is 222 Southwest Columbia Street, Suite 400 in Portland. And as mentioned, I am counsel for First American Title Insurance Company. First, I'd like to thank two people in particular for this bill. Number one, the assistance of Representative Esquivel, and secondly, the county clerk, James Morales, and the Association of the County Clerks in working together with me to resolve some of these issues. The first thing I do want to make clear is that although I am a counsel for a title insurance company, this is really not a title insurance company bill. What we're talking about are recording documents that affect the lives and the economies of individuals and companies. So it's the person who's sitting there with the moving van waiting so they can move in until documents get recorded that are really the persons who are benefited by making sure that these things are clarified. Let me just give you a very brief background as to how we got here. It's the law of unintended consequences. I and some other people in the industry met with members of the County Clerks Association a number of years ago to try to clarify what kind of documents could be recorded and to assist people at the county clerk's desk office where they were accepting these documents to make it easier. One of the things that was done was to create a list of documents by title and by other references to allow sort of a threshold. You see these, they're okay, we don't need to look at them. However, as I say, the law of unintended consequences took place, and that became a minimum maximum. So if it didn't fit within this criteria, with the title in particular, then the documents were rejected. Not looking at the substance of the document and as to whether or not it qualified to be recorded. So, as indicated earlier, there's a fairly broad discrepancy in how these documents are treated. So that's how we got here. That's why this bill exists. It has three distinct parts. They all have to do with recording, and I'll just summarize briefly what those three are. Section 1, paragraph 2, which appears on page 2, relates to the issue of title. If it doesn't have a title, it still can be recorded, assuming it meets all the other requirements. So those situations where the clerk is simply rejecting it because they don't like the title, that would take away that ability. Section 2 on that same page simply relates to a difference of opinion as to how or whether certain documents could be recorded. Those documents in particular are those that contain two or more persons transferring an interest in real estate. Some people have interpreted this provision to say that you can't do that, whereas I believe the intention of the bill is to allow that to happen, simply provides for additional costs for indexing as it may appear. And then the third section has to do with memorializing agreements that have been made between a borrower and a lender. For various reasons, which I won't go into unless you would like, lenders make mistakes, and then these mistakes need to be corrected, particularly in the area, two areas. One, where they've said that a note or a lien interest has been satisfied and the document is recorded, which does that. That's a mistake. They need to fix that mistake. And unfortunately, because of this list that I mentioned earlier, the documents necessary to memorialize that on the record have been refused by county clerks. So what we've done here is to create a form that allows for the recording of the document to correct the record, to reflect agreements, substantive agreements that have been made between the parties that is off record. So we want to record a document on the record in which reflects that agreement. Those are the three major sections in the bill. I'm more than happy to try to answer questions. I should add, as indicated, I have met with the County Clerks Association, and we do have agreed, certainly, and I believe Representative Esquivel has agreed to the changes that they are suggesting, with one minor one, and I'm sure we can work that one out too.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Brickley. Are there questions for either Representative Esquivel or Mr. Brickley? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Brickley and Representative Escoval, for bringing this bill. On previous bills, we've heard some testimony and some opinions about the wisdom or lack thereof of putting form-like documents into statutes. And I wonder if you considered, and I think that's because they tend to change, or you start using them and you realize you need a little change here or there, but now it's in the statute. I wonder if you've considered an option of referring to this type of correction of errors document in the statute, but then having the form be a separate standalone document so that you won't have to come back here every time you need to change the form.
Yes, that was considered. I think part of the... I'm sorry. Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, thank you.
You're fine.
In response to that question, yes, that was considered. I think part of the problem is that if there's generalized language referring to a type of document, that, again, it would be open to interpretation from 36 county clerks as to whether or not that particular document meets the requirements of the statute. So it was my thought that it would be appropriate to create a form. It's a very simple form. It would be hard to see how you could, what you would have to change, although it's certainly possible. And all it does really is to just reflect the fact that there's been a substantive agreement off record, and hopefully it's just a simple notice.
Thank you.
Well, it's kind of following up on that point, Mr. Brickley. Ordinarily, if a document that's been recorded has an error in it, it would seem like the most logical thing you'd do is you'd have a corrected document and you would record that.
That's correct.
So why should there be a form for correction of error that is its own kind of standalone, check-the-box kind of form? I would have thought. I mean, I can understand if the whole original document was just it was just wrong to have recorded it. So say it's a loan that really wasn't satisfied, so a reconveyance was done incorrectly. I can see the need for this, but otherwise, if there's an error in the loan amount or in the payoff date or some other kind of error, why wouldn't you simply record a document that has the correct information in it?
You would, Mr. Chair. You would have that kind of a document, and that's what is done in those situations. This is designed, at least, to refer to those kinds of documents which should not have been recorded in the first place or should not have been recorded in that format. And the two instances are the ones that, one of which you've already identified, and that is a reconveyance document where the lender has, for various reasons, authorized a document satisfying the lien altogether or partially when they didn't intend to. So this is to set aside that particular document. The other situation is where the foreclosure department of a lender does not talk to the workout department of the lender. The workout department has created an agreement with the borrower to reinstate their loan. They don't tell the foreclosure department. The foreclosure department goes ahead, holds the sale, but then needs to set aside that document because of the prior agreement. So this is designed essentially to set aside those two forms of documents that, as I say, should not have been recorded at all. In those other instances where there are errors in the document that need to be amended, that is exactly what does happen. The document itself, with the amendment, is recorded. New amounts, new maturity dates, that sort of thing.
And then back on the earlier changes, the language of the new section, subsection 2 on page 2, lines 14 to 16, stating that the clerk may not refuse because of the title. So it sounds like it's suggesting that any title would be allowed. That is, that they, even if it was a title that was completely misleading in how and what it was saying was happening in the underlying document, that could still, at least the clerks would be fine. They would be directed, in effect, to go ahead and record whatever it is that's handed in or transmitted for recording, which seems a lot, perhaps odd to me if it were something that just on its face was misleading. And then maybe just another part to the question here. Could you elaborate a little further on what kind of extraneous information you're concerned about?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, let me address the second question first, and that is extraneous information. The most common kind of extraneous information is a map, a plat map or something that has the effect of explaining or further documenting the legal description of the property. Other kinds of things that might be attached could be documents from other jurisdictions. In the case of a probate, for example, in Washington, we might want to record a document that would include letters, testamentary, or other items of authority, and we would attach that to a deed, for example, to be recorded. Those are the kinds of documents that would constitute extraneous information in the view of some clerks, and they have refused to allow that to be recorded. The first question relating to the title, I think that's probably correct, that a document couldn't be refused for a title. That's directly responding to this issue that, as I mentioned earlier, the unintended consequences of using the title as kind of a touchstone for purposes of authorization. Lawyers who draft documents come up with very interesting titles, they have pride of authorship, and they don't like to change them. And so they get submitted. And I think the ultimate question, however, is for the county clerk, and that is, where does it belong? Is it belong in the mortgage records? Does it belong in the deed records? You know, what type of interest does this affect? And it's the indexing, ultimately, of the document that's going to control, not really the title.
So I think what I'm hearing you say is that you want the the title treated as not having any substantive significance.
Exactly.
It's like a very common provision in a contract will say that the titles, the section headings, are not of substantive significance, and it's the text that has significance.
Exactly.
Okay. Any further questions for these witnesses?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Esquivel.
I think that what this boils down to is we have 36 county clerks, probably 37, 38 different opinions when we start talking about titles. Same with attorneys, same with legislators. No matter how many you have in a room, you have that many and more opinions of what we do. So I think that's what this is trying to get to, is to get to the meat of the item instead of necessarily hanging our hats on a title.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. And Mr. Brickley, if you had the time to remain for the remainder of this hearing, and we have another bill on similar subject matter, which you're not signed up for, but if you were present in the room to hear the discussion of that, it would give us perhaps greater comfort that we were getting all the perspectives we need. Oh,
certainly. I'd be more than happy to do that. And which bill was that?
It's the last one on our agenda, House Bill 3119, about recording extraneous information and instruments by
okay.
County clerks. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
And now, James Morales from the Association of County Clerks.
Good morning, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. James Morales, Benton County Clerk. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Association of County Clerks. The written testimony here really is just mapping out the amendments that I've discussed with Mr. Brickley and Representative Esquivel to date. It is, for the most part, what you've seen has been agreed upon. There are a couple of issues that we still need to iron out. One of the amendments is with regard to the county clerk instrument. with regard to the title or extraneous information. The clerks felt it important to say notwithstanding ORS 205-2361, which is another area that is being amended in the bill. And the reason for that is, yes, we do need some clarity in the title to be able to ensure that we index these documents into the proper record. And so that's what we're asking for there, members of the committee. So that, and that was agreed to. And one of the things that we've also asked to be changed, and this is where we've differed, is on page 2, lines 24, I think 25, 26. I have 24 twice there, but which is my third, fourth paragraph in the testimony, where we're asking for may instead of shall. We felt that the bill as written with the shall in there was going to require multiple titles on a document. We often accept documents that only have a single title. And so we're saying that may makes more difference. That way it's allowing for both single and multiple titled instruments. So I've explained that in the testimony. Working my way through this, we thought it was important to make it clear that what we're doing here is creating a process for erroneously recorded documents, not documents that were recorded with errors. And so that's some of the... it says to correct, the way it's written, it says to correct an error in a recorded trust deed. That's not what's being asked for. They're asking to correct an erroneously recorded trust deed related instrument. And so, and they've been amenable to these types of things. Just clarifying what we're looking for here is some clarity in the bill so that it actually is doing what we think is being asked for here. One of the areas where the clerks did express some concerns in our discussions regarding this legislation was the rescission that this document will allow of a trustee's deed. This is a trust-related document, and a trustee's deed does convey title on the sale of real property, and so this would allow that transaction to be rescinded, essentially. But we are, like, as stated by Mr. Brickley, we are working with them to get these amendments into the bill, and I think that we should be able to do it. The clerks are neutral. This is what the title companies are looking for. We just want to make sure it does what they're asking for and doesn't leave room for... I guess, interpretations that could cause problems unforeseen in the future. Any questions?
Ms. Morales, did you speak to the proposed change on page 4, on the back side of your handout here? I'm just trying to understand...
Yes. There's two different circumstances here where the signer of the original document will be different than what was originally stated in the bill, where we have a beneficiary of the original trust deed is what the original bill stated as the signer for the correction of errors form. The beneficiary would be the signer in the case of an erroneously recorded reconveyance on a deed of trust, which is when you've paid off your loan and you get a deed of reconveyance to indicate that the bank or the lender is releasing you of any obligation and their interest in the property. So That is correct. In the case of a trustee's deed, the trustee is who's going to be signing this over, not the beneficiary. And that's why we wanted to make sure that the form met with the two processes that are in the form. They're two separate processes.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Morales? Mr. Morales, I'm still trying to get a focus on where this set of changes would be taking us. It sounds like it's that sort of the general thrust is that the county clerks, as a result of these changes, would not be in a position to question what's being offered in for recording. That is, whatever you're provided, whether it has, regardless of how it's captioned or titled, regardless of what material may be attached to it, it's sent in for recording, a person pays their fee, it goes into the deed or mortgage records. Is that the thrust of what's going on here?
That is one of the major concerns that Mr. Brickley has brought forward as one. His experience after having created what they call a recording standards document, where it's a document that has a list of acceptable titles and it cites the authorizing ORSs that allow for the recording of certain documents into the real property records. Mr. Brickley's experience, as I understand it, is that he has certain county clerks, to which I am not sure who they are, but that use that as the only acceptable titles. And so what he's trying to do through this legislation, I believe, is to open that up a little. What the amendment that I've asked for is to still give us some ability to say, hey, this title is not clearly stated enough for us to get it into the appropriate record. And that's why I'd like to add the notwithstanding ORS 205-2361, which I had mentioned earlier, which would still require that the instrument presented for recordation be labeled in sufficient detail to enable the clerk to record the transactions in the appropriate records. So we could still say this does not have a title that would allow us to index this document into the appropriate record.
Okay. Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Morales.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2959 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3119. Council Plummer, give us a little introduction to this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3119 prohibits county clerks from removing or redacting extraneous information from a properly filed and recorded instrument from the records. It also states that county clerks will not incur civil or criminal liability for refusing to remove or redact extraneous information from a properly filed and recorded instrument from the records. There are some proposed dash one amendments that committee members should have. The amendment states that including extraneous information in an instrument is the voluntary act of the person presenting that instrument, and that the clerk shall record instruments without regard to whether that instrument contains extraneous information.
Okay, we have two witnesses signed up, Jan Coleman and James Morales. And if they could come forward together. This bill was at the request of the Oregon Association of County Clerks. I'll let you go in whatever order you wish, but identify yourselves for the record when you begin.
Okay, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Jan Coleman. I'm the Amhill County Clerk, and today I'm representing the Oregon Association of County Clerks. Like I'm sure you have experienced, the way the bill originally came out and how our intent was, were quite a bit different. So that's why you see the amendments. And even there, I'm not quite sure it's coming out exactly as we would like, but let me touch on our intent for you. We felt the purpose of our bill, 3119, is to protect the public record and to prevent removal of previous recorded documents or contents of previously recorded documents. Because we feel that these are historical, they're part of Oregon's history, and they are also part of current owners' history, business interests, and they also take part in the operation of various government agencies. ORS 205-130 establishes the county clerk as the archivist in counties, and it charges us with custody and safekeeping of all our files, of the records of deeds, mortgages, real property, etc. So we take this very much to heart, and we feel like we are very much charged with the keeping of that record, and that it has been threatened in the last few years. Also, public records law is recognizing that these are permanent records through administrative rules through the Archives Division. So we want them totally recognized as permanent records in the state that they are now. Anyway, we're in with this bill, we're trying to preserve the integrity of these records. And we want them done wholly. We don't want anything taken out of these records or redacted. We think that this is historical record and should remain so. The other part of our bill that we are including there is that going forward from now on, if things like Social Security numbers are presented to us on these documents, and that does occasionally happen, not very often, but it does, the lien records are the ones that we're more likely to have them because IRS gives us a Social Security number. So, but any time that this is going forward, we would like to have that, if it is presented to us, it is knowingly done so by the party, and they know that they are placing it on the public record. Anyway, right. Go ahead. James, like to comment.
James Morales, Benton County Clerk, on behalf of the Oregon Association of County Clerks, and my address is the Benton County Courthouse in Corvallis, Oregon. So, Chair McPherson, members of the committee, hopefully, to clarify what we're trying to ask for, but we haven't quite grasped it so far in the language of the bill, is that what we're looking for is when a document is recorded or an instrument is recorded in our record or has already been recorded, that the information that was recorded in that document was voluntarily submitted by the recording party. Now, the IRS does not put Social Security on their documents anymore. They've gone to the practice of only the last four digits, as has the state of Oregon and Benton County, or the counties. So, that practice has largely been halted based on, you know, fears for identity theft. What we're looking for is if there are bills that seek to redact this type of information, that they are go forward. That they say we start from the passage of this bill forward, and the statute is to say you can't go back and pull things out of the record that met the statutes at the time they were recorded. And so that was the language we were looking to get, and we ended up kind of all over the board with some of this language. But we just want to ensure that documents, once they're in our records, because we microfilm these records, they go, copies are sent to the title companies where they have copies of our microfilm and our digital images of the documents that are recorded in our offices. So once they are recorded, It's out there. It's public record. For us to try and go out there and pull these things back and redact information is virtually mission impossible. That's why we say if it's going to be done, make it go forward. Whatever's been accepted and already, keep the integrity of the record intact. Really, there's nothing we can do about it anyway, and it's a very expensive and tedious proposition to think that we would be able to do that. So that's really what we're trying to capture and haven't quite got it yet in this bill.
because the amendment is fairly long here, I've been just trying to kind of piece it together and understand what's happening. It looks to me as though this concept that was in the bill before, in the original printed bill, about creating a shield from liability for failure to or refusing to remove or redact extraneous information. Looks like that's gone from the bill now. Is that right? Or am I just not piecing it together right?
Chair McPherson, on page 3 of the amendment, we were afraid of that too, but after we finally looked at it, on page 3 of the amendment, about line 11, it starts addressing back to the original bill.
Yes, I see that.
And I believe pretty much leaves, you know, it just telling what it takes out of the bill.
But I see on line 13 of page 3, it says in line 17 through 20, delete the bold-faced material. So it looks to me like it's removing the material that was on the original lines 18 to 20 of the printed bill.
It is, and we asked for that because,
frankly,
we weren't looking for, in this bill, we weren't looking to protect our liability here.
Gotcha.
We were looking to protect the record.
Yes, I understand. I understand. So that concept is sort of a shield from liability has gone out from the bill under these amendments.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Much of this came out of legislative council, and that's why we're trying to get this language clarified, Chair. Sorry about that.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm trying to figure out, to follow up on your question, if lines in the original bill, not the amendments, if lines 5 through 7 still remain, or are those deleted? Because I can't find a reference to deleting them, but maybe I'm not looking in the right place.
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici. I'm no expert at reading these, but my assumption is that he's leaving the bill intact, and then these are just the alterations he's doing to them from line...
Page 3.
Yeah, on page 3 from lines 11 through 14. Otherwise...
The way I read it... Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Okay.
Thank you. The way I read it, then, lines 5 through 7 are still in.
Yes.
Is that your understanding?
That's my understanding.
Yes.
And my concern, and maybe you can enlighten me on this, is what if there's a court order, for example?
If there's a court...
And according to this, you can't take anything out under any circumstances. But what if there's a court order that says that needs to happen for some reason?
Representative Bonamici, Chair McPherson, that was part of our concern, is that, as I was saying, it's really the horse is out of the corral already. If we're required to go back and redact something that's already been made a part of our permanent microfilm records, these records are shared outside of our office, not only internally in the county, but also with our business partners, mainly the title companies, and redacting that information, it's just not a doable thing. We could redact it from our records, but it's still out there. And that's the problem we're having. We're saying it has to be go forward. If it's go backward, the result could be we're closing the public record. We would have to say, okay, if this cannot be made available by court order, even, we would have to close the public record until we could get Mission Impossible as close to accomplished as we possibly could, which would be very detrimental to the business interests and real estate industry in general. So that's what we were trying to address here, because we've seen a lot of bills come through in the past few legislative sessions that could possibly do that, close the public record.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a follow-up question,
please? Please.
I'm trying to get a sense of the scope of the problem, because there's we're kind of in a different day and age now with identity theft. And if in fact there are a lot of public documents that include, or a lot of public record documents that include full Social Security numbers, are we looking at a few here and there, or are we looking at a lot of these? I think that's going to be a huge concern to people if they know that Social Security numbers are on the public record. And I appreciate your concern about that in the other way, but the consumer's concern is going to be tremendous. So are we looking at a small problem, or are we looking at a big problem?
Representative Bonamici, Chair McPherson, what we're saying is, yes, we recognize that this is a problem, and there are not a lot of documents, because most parties have taken the proactive measure of not including this type of information in their documents. Over the last several years, it has gone to virtually, we don't see it anymore. Mm-hmm. But for instance, if we do have a federal tax lien or something of this nature that was initially recorded before the concerns for Social Security numbers became such a large thing in the public interest, the release of that lien was often drafted at the time of the initial production of the lien. In those cases, when the parties or the IRS submits the release at the time that the payment has been obtained by the IRS, the originally created document will be submitted, and in those cases, we still do see like a Social Security number or something like that. What we're trying to say is that when a party submits something that is not required, that the extraneous information not required for recording, that it not be the clerk's responsibility to seek through each of these documents to see if the party has submitted information not required for recording. So if it so happens that they've included something that they probably shouldn't have, that it not be our responsibility to go out there and redact that information, because we're talking a lot of reading a lot of work to do that.
Chair McPherson, if I may.
Please.
There are a number of states that have instituted similar laws and various, you know, tweakings of it. California has pretty much the same that we're asking for right now, where the record remains as it is, and anyone who presents that type of thing for recording does so knowingly that it's going on the public record.
And we had a bill just before that talked about extraneous information, but the focus there seemed to be on additional documents,
right,
that were aside from the main thrust of the,
exactly,
of the instrument that was being recorded, whereas the extraneous information that's the focus here, all the same terminology, seems to be sensitive personal information, so particularly Social Security numbers.
Non-required information for recording.
Which could be. Excuse me.
Sure.
Okay. I think I finally sort of understand the structure of the amendments, and while there's a lot of text here running on some
yes,
10 pages, there's actually not very much being changed.
Yes, I think he brought in all the statutes where a reference to what he was changing had to be tweaked a little.
Right.
You know,
and really
it takes a little reading to get through it all. That's
right. And so the original first bold language of the printed bill is still in the bill.
Yes.
That is the statement in the new subsection 1 of ORS 205-244 that says, when an instrument is improperly filed and recorded, the county clerk may not remove from the instrument from the records or redact extraneous information from the instrument. So that would still be in the bill.
And then there's a this addition to ORS 205-130, which is sort of a parallel concept. The county clerk shall record or cause to be recorded in a legible and permanent manner, et cetera, all instruments that are required or permitted by law to be recorded without regard to whether the instrument contains extraneous information. So one case we're saying you will not remove or redact extraneous information. The other case, other section, it's saying you will or shall record regardless of whether it contains extraneous information. I want to focus on the third piece of new language, which is on the top of page 3 of the amendments. Presentment for recording is a voluntary act of the person who presents the instrument for recording. And I'm just the language strikes me as a little bit odd, because what is the, is it presumed to be voluntary? Is it deemed to be voluntary? I mean, what you're trying to get at is you don't want to take any responsibility for what people are bringing forward for recording. But I'm just wondering whether that language does the desired job of it.
It could be, Chairman McPherson, members of the committee. We do feel like there is a simpler answer to the legislative language that you have before you, and that's why we'd like to ask the committee for the opportunity to seek that simplified language in an amendment that we could bring forth to the committee.
Okay, good. Are there any further questions for these witnesses? Representative Flores?
Thank you. Not a question, but a clarification, I think. In the Dash 1 amendments that we're looking at, it begins in line 2 of the printed bill, and I'm presuming that it is addressing page 1, but it, since the printed bill is only one page, I guess that's a natural assumption. But it deletes the reference to ORS 205.244 and inserts the 203 references and 205. And so if it's deleting the reference to ORS 205.244, that is the language that's in the current printed bill, section 1. So I'm curious. I don't see it move forward.
It threw me off a little bit to begin with, but you'll actually see ORS 205.244 in that string of references.
Right, thank you.
So
is then section 1 that's in the current printed bill incorporated in the Dash 1 amendment somewhere, re-section numbered?
It is, in effect, I finally concluded, because it's after line 3, this whole section 1 of the that's in the amendment on from starting on page 1 and continuing till page 3 is inserted, but then you resume with on page 3 of the amendment, line 11, references in line 4, then the section number 1 is changed to a 2 and
gotcha.
So on.
Gotcha. Okay.
It's a little elusive.
It is.
Okay. Well, if there are no further questions, then I think that this needs a little bit of tinkering around to get this bill into shape. I'd asked Mr. Brickley to remain. Mr. Brickley, don't feel under any obligation to come and offer any comments, but because you're in the industry that uses this service, I just thought I'd give it an opportunity if you had any thoughts.
Not really. Our association looked at the original bill and really have no objection to it at all.
Okay, very good.
Can I ask one more brief question, please?
Okay, very good.
My curiosity is, on the original bill in the lines 5 through 7 where it says that the county clerk may not redact extraneous information. If I went in there with a big marker, could I redact my Social Security number if it's on a document? I know this says you can't, but can I as a member of the public?
Right.
If it's extraneous.
Chair McPherson, representing Bonamici, most of this information is on microfilm. So you could not do that.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Bonamici, Chair McPherson, you could do that prior to recording it at the counter, wherever, but not after it's been recorded.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, then excuse these witnesses and close the public hearing on House Bill 3119. And members, I'm going to open a work session on the first bill we took up, House Bill 2017. You'll recall that this bill was the one that states that the court shall maintain, take into account, or is it may?
May
take into account. It's may, and that's an important distinction. May take into account the presence of whether a parent or a parent's ability to maintain a tobacco smoke-free environment. And I think it's a fairly simple bill, and I thought we could discuss it and decide whether action should be taken on it. Representative Wisdom.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and no disrespect, but I would like to have had an input from the courts and DHS. I think everyone thinks that's a good idea, but what are we putting the burden on the courts and the DHS system? And I apologize I was not here for the complete testimony, but...
Representative Krieger.
We've looked at this as smoking. You could say the same thing about providing fat food in your family.
Thank you.
Is there alcohol in the home? I think the court can already do that if you look what's in the bottom section. I think it's almost like it's repeating itself. I'm not convinced that the bill is even needed. If you look at, I think it was section two.
Lifestyle.
Yeah, three. We're down to four. I mean, it always says if it causes physical damage, they can do that. So it may be just restating it, but I just don't think it's necessary.
Mr. Chair, I think that it's a possibility that's being considered already under paragraph 3 and 4. But as somebody who just lost a parent to tobacco-related illness, I would support this bill just to make sure that it's clear that it can be considered as a factor. I wouldn't mind talking to some family law practitioners, though, about how this paragraph 3 or 4 is being interpreted. But at this point, I would support the bill.
Why don't we seek some further input from people who have experience in this field and decide whether this would have a positive impact. Okay, I will close the work session on House Bill 2017, and that concludes our agenda today, committee. Thank you very much.
Another little point. I know you're close, but if this has to do with custody from a married situation, and you're not that far from the Department of Human Resources dependency, where those types of things might be considered as to whether or not be a foster parent, and we've got a whole bunch of dependency bills coming that deal with what that agency has got to do about placement of children. Representative Flores was on a work group, Richardson was, and Representative Schaffler. And I don't want this to bleed over into that, because we're making major, that kind of a thought press, we're making major changes now in how that agency operates and what things DHS caseworkers should be considering when they decide who should have a parent and what home is acceptable and not acceptable, those types of things. And though it's two separate, I can just see where that could lead us to, and we have more complexity of finding proper homes for kids than we've already got.
Okay, well, that concludes our agenda. We're adjourned.